Well, welcome to the session and good afternoon. And it's my pleasure to be the moderator for Power of Commission hearings. It's going to revolve around a special panel and some wonderful select videotaped testimonies. But we also hope very much that we'll garner your participation. So I hope there are some folks in here that either gave testimony at the various CWRIC sites in the early 1980s or that have seen tapes or read accounts of these testimonies. That's our focus this afternoon. So we want to review and reconsider the importance of the 1981 Commission on the Wartime Relocation and Internment of civilians hearings. I'll probably just call it the C. We'll probably just call it the CWRIC hearings for short, or maybe just the hearings. And to recall how seminal these hearings were to the former incarcerees, to the Japanese American community at large, as well as to just-minded friends and supporters. And a lot of folks that were involved in the LA hearings participated in formulating this panel, so you'll get to meet some of them this afternoon, and we'll periodically try to remember, recognize, and thank everyone, because I'd say, 10 or 15 people have had input into making this. It's not just me or us up in front here, although we do have a wonderful panel made up of Kathy Masaoka to my immediate left, Richard Kasuda, and Kei Ochi. And I do want to point out that a number of the NCR people did help Steve Nagano, who's going to be up front mastering our videotaped clips this afternoon. So we'll probably meet some more people as well. In particular, we want to remember the importance of the testimonies on the redress reparation campaigns. In terms of the testimonies themselves, and, you know, I've seen a lot of these testimonies over the years. I've used a number of tapes in my classes, but as we were watching on Steve's TV at one meeting, some of the playbacks, I mean, tears were coming to my eyes, even though some of them I'd seen, I don't know, at least 3, 4, 5 times. So the testimonies themselves, I think, that were captured at the LA hearings are important. And I think we'll have a chance to maybe get into what the testimonies were like in other settings, including the fact that maybe it appears that some of the testimonies are lost or strayed. I was talking to someone saying that they're not sure, quite sure where the San Francisco testimonies are anymore, which would really be a tragedy. So maybe we can share some information about that. So we want to remember the importance of the testimonies themselves, and we want to recall the tremendous impact that the testimonies had on the commission's final report, right? Personal justice denied, as well as their recommendations, because, you know, the testimonies and then the report lead right into the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. So we really wanted to recall that. But I would also add, I think it's a blueprint for organizing methodology in general. And maybe at the end we can come back to some of the educational implications that the hearings and the tapes and so forth have at that broader level. So today's program will be divided into 3 parts, and we'll ask you, our audience, to participate as well. Part 1 is going to focus on the CWRIC hearings in Los Angeles, and in particular, NCR's work to influence inclusiveness in terms of the folks that were invited to and allowed to and enabled to testify, and the effectiveness, because that was something that was partially, I would say, by design, right? Folks were rehearsed. Folks were given an opportunity to write, practice, and so forth, as we'll hear about. Part 2, we want to get into the range of testimonies, because even though they were LA-based, there were folks living in the Southern California region that had their roots in the Pacific Northwest and talked about the Pacific Northwest experience. So we wanted to bring those to you today as well. And then in part three, to talk about the importance and effect of the commission hearings. And I think in relationship to each part, I want to be able to stop and invite anybody to comment based on their own reflections about CWRIC hearings that were held in other places of the United States as well. So without further ado, I'd like to launch into the program then that will begin with NCRR's influence on the Los Angeles hearings. And in that regard, we're going to start with a video screening that would be approximately 8 minutes worth of CWRIC hearings, again, from the Los Angeles iteration of this event.
And it's a devastating indictment of our government and of our society.
Within minutes, Nirmala was overtaken by the military, who blocked off the very building and the bridge, and they came to my bedroom. Then they flashed, FBI, hey, get your phone on, man. I'm taking you in. I said, what for? You're an alien, enemy alien.
I asked him, when will he return? The FBI agent asked, replied, you may never see him again.
After 2.5 years, he was returned to us, broken in health and in spirit.
I was handed a notice of suspension without pay and told not to return. I was personally charged as being used by the Japanese government as a spy.
After war was declared a nightmare began for me and my family. I did not know then that it would be 4.5 years before I would see any of them again.
Newspapers and radios are blasting out, calling us a dirty name, saying that all Japs are no good.
I thought of the prize-winning essay that I had written for my high school English class, and it was titled, Why I Am Proud to Be an American. I cried out in my heart, how could you do this to us?
On the train, we first time I had a speech. And some of these old men said, the old men say, hey, they're beating us because we're going to die. They're going to kill us. We're going to do that kind of stuff, man. You know, it's a democratic country, Bill of Rights, constitutional, and they all like that. Jeff, go with it, D. But they're not going to do that. This is democracy. You know what one old man say? No, this is not democracy. This is democracy, he said.
We were the only Japanese-American family on Kodiak, in Kodiak, Alaska. In a short time, my father and two uncles were arrested and put in concentration camps. I have not seen my father since I was 11 years old. I am now 51 years old. I have missed my father very much, and I wonder. I wonder if he's alive today. I cannot help but be very angry at the United States.
It is now unimaginable living in horse stable.
Hundreds upon hundreds had severe reactions consisting of high fever, chills, sore arms, and severe diarrhea.
The WRA began conducting a hearing. Are you willing to serve for the United States in case of an enemy invader does? And another one like, are you willing to be loyal to the United States? I wrote no all the way through. My blood was burning with agony and frustration. I was so disgusted that I requested for deportation to Japan, a country I had never seen before. Then I was sent to Tula Lake.
We know how some people are.
Now wait a sec.
The outhouse had no partition, just a board and holes cut into them. At 2 a.m., we were informed that our baby had passed away.
The MPs fired shots into the defenseless crowd. A classmate, Jimmy Ito, was shot and killed.
I have never been able to talk about this. More people have come up to me and said, I must speak up. My children, even my own children, don't know that my brother was shot in the back.
I remembered feeling bad about being Japanese. We wanted to believe that America did not hate and reject us. This is the same psychological defense that beaten and abused children use. Our scars are permanent and deep.
The loss of your human dignity, self-esteem, pride can never be replaced.
We still carry bitter memories and regret when recalling those events.
The most valuable thing I lost was my freedom.
Huge chunks of dignity and self-respect were stripped from Japanese Americans 40 years ago.
And I just couldn't imagine my government would do this to me.
So you're trying to hurry me, and I will not be hurried by you as a representative of this government ever. I've been rushed by this government enough.
The only place that we could afford was under our house.
Then I returned to the United States at the age of 55. After 55, I can't do anything.
You may wish to simply read the English translation.
They worked very hard to prepare this testimony, and I appreciate if you would let them speak in Japanese. Thank you.
The problem we have here is one of time.
But these Japanese-speaking individuals being told to shut up most of their life.
It's not being suggested we're trying to shut anybody up.
Can I have just Japanese without translation? They can turn in their written English translation.
Whatever their pleasure is would be fine with the commission.
No, it is. Right.
He wants to speak in Japanese.
Fine.
Present Nippon において漁業者として最高にとも言える栄養漁業集合化のため一応かつて思わざる家族セーブントの職をあえてしなければ
投げ込んでちょうど豚と同じようにされました。戦争も終わりまして収容所の管理人が来ましてキャンプから出ろということを言いました。どこへ出るんですかって言いました。我らは何もありません。どこへ行くところもありません。またその考えもありません。我々はここにいましょうって言いました。あなた方が入れたのですから我々は。
Although no amount of monetary compensation can bring back our son, I do feel we are justified in requesting and accepting compensation
for the minimum of $50,000 each.
No amount of money can ever replace and bring back my dear brother.
I now demand a monetary compensation of $1 million. I also demand a monetary compensation of $500,000 each to my five children.
That a large number of persons, primarily Isseis, who really needed this monetary support are no longer with us today.
My students ask me if this can happen again to another group of people. I must answer yes. There is no price tag for freedom.
I don't think we ever did get out of camp. I think we're beginning to get out of camp now.
So I'd like to ask our panelists in sequence, Richard, Kathy, and Kay, and they're going to speak to the impact of testifying in regard to the Issei speakers and NCRR's role in popularizing the call for redress. Kathy will speak to the nature of the hearings and mobilization, and Kay to NCRR's demands.
So you got a glimpse, a little taste of what the commission hearings were like in Los Angeles, and maybe a kind of a sense of what the hearings were like, and also the World War II incarceration itself. So with that, maybe as you think about it, maybe you could ask yourself, how do you recover from something so devastating and deep as the World War II incarceration? You had to start your lives over. So how, you have to be so strong and single-minded to be able to start thinking, what am I going to do with my life? But how do you start over when you're 60 years old? So you got to think, like, for the Issei, the first generation, this was their plight. Because average age was in the mid-50s for the Issei males. And so, you know, how are you going to start your life over? And the camps had already subverted the Issei as authority figures and breadwinners in their family and community. And so it's like, okay, what do you do now? Issei were so isolated and hamstrung in the lack of opportunities to try to make it into society. They were Japanese speaking, and I don't know if you know that they were prohibited from becoming naturalized citizens until 1952, well after World War II. And so they had, you know, everything against them. So if you just try to place yourself in their shoes after World War II, and then think in 1981, as we're preparing for the commission hearings, think as if you're an Issei, and you've been put through all of this, and think of how you would feel about being asked to testify, you know, against this government that had done this to you in front of representatives of that same government. It would just be so daunting and scary. I was fortunate enough to work in 1981 at the UICAI, or Japanese American Community Service, in San Jose. So I worked closely with Issei. And I felt it was really important to be able, for them to be able to speak out. And so I tried to get a group to testify, but I knew it would be really tough. And so what I did was I focused on one Issei, who was this really super feisty woman. And I thought, okay, if we can get her, you know, I think we'll be okay. But even with her, I was having a hard time, you know, because she was saying, oh, I don't have anything to say. They're not going to listen to an old woman like me, this kind of thing. But finally, I thought, okay, I asked her, well, how about konomo no tameni, for the sake of your children, your grandchildren? And that got her to perk up and said, yeah, maybe, Hans. And she said yes, she would do it. And after she said yes, it was relatively easy to get four other Issei to testify. So imagine yourself again as one of these Issei going from San Jose up to San Francisco to testify in front of the U.S. government, basically. So, you know, imagine what are you thinking and feeling? And so in the van that transported the Issei up to San Francisco, there was utter tension. You could hear a pin drop in there. But once they got on stage, they were magnificent. Excuse me. They were, you know, just boldly spoke out, you know, against that government. And it was just, you know, you could feel the power within them when they did that. And with that, on their way home to San Jose, it was a complete turnaround in their feelings because they were laughing and singing shigins and all, because you could tell that that lifted this great burden from the shoulders and felt so good about having spoken up.
Okay, I think what Richard just talked about was pretty well seen in the video with Issei testifying. Those are only two of the maybe five that did testify. And they were equally as strong, I'm sure, as the ones in San Jose or San Francisco. NCR had just formed the founding conference was in 1980, November. And, you know, many of the NCR members had come off of a decade of organizing in Little Tokyos and, you know, anti-war work and all of those kind of activities. So we were kind of primed to organize around redress in 1980-81. And when the commission hearings came up, as you can see, it was a very lively session in L.A., three days and an evening session. But our first reaction to the commission hearings was, why do they have to have a commission to find out if a wrong was committed? Isn't it obvious? And so it kind of made us a little angry at first, like, well, we're not going to, you know, participate in this. You know, that was our where we were coming from at that time. But I think we quickly realized that it was going to happen, and we should make use of it and do the best that we could and bring as many people to the commission hearings and make it as inclusive and participatory as possible. So when we heard that it was just going to be in Washington, D.C., a few cities, they were talking about academicians and experts testifying. We said, that's not the way it should be. It should be the people who are experienced should be testifying. You know, so it expanded to more cities where Japanese Americans were concentrated. We pushed for simultaneous translation because we had a lot of Issei living at that time in the communities. And we also pushed for an evening session at Little Tokyo Towers, as well as transportation for the Issei to come. And we had lunchtime sessions to brief people. You know, a lot of the Nisei were working at that time, so the evening session was the one time that they could actually participate. So, you know, it was kind of important to have that one. So you saw Lillian Baker. That was Lillian Baker grabbing the testimony of Jim Kawaminami, who was a 442 guy. And people are not going to put up with that stuff. They were shouting to get her out. And, you know, when Hayaka testified, people booed him, you know, and admonished. And you saw Jim Matsuoka, you know, arguing with the commissioners, saying, I'm not going to be rushed, because they were constantly rushing people. And people had been waiting a long time to speak. You know, it was like, how many years? Give them the time to speak. You know, and then the Issei were told, well, you can't speak in Japanese. Just give us a translation. Well, who was going to do it? A translator. You know, so all of those things, you know, we were ready to react to all of that and to make sure that people were going to be heard. But as Lane said, and I think Richard said, it wasn't easy to get people to agree to testify at first. And we were even saying, many of us better sign up to testify because it doesn't look like we're going to get enough people. Because people were feeling like, you know, what the heck? This government put me in camp? I mean, what are they going to do? There was a lot of defeatism, what we saw throughout the movement. And there was also fear. So, you know, it was hard. But once it started rolling, people heard that others were testifying. More and more people came to practice sessions. They got help writing it up, practicing, all of that. You know, so I just want to comment that Janice Tanaka, who's filming this workshop right now, is one of the people that helped to videotape the commission hearing. So NCR and Visual Communications had the foresight, I would say now, to have videotaped all of the 3 days and 23 hours of testimonies, and we're glad that that happened.
I would like to just share that one of NCRR's strengths, and we're based primarily in L.A., but back in the day, 1980-81, we had, you know, different organizations in New York, the Bay Area, San Jose, San Diego, and we all worked concertedly on the redress effort. But the commission hearings, in 1981, this is, you know, like an example is trying to get people to testify. It comes with this whole history, 40 years of silence. And so to get them to testify was so very difficult. But I'm really, really proud of NCRR because it had the foresight to have a testifier present our demands on behalf of NCRR. Was the National Coalition for Redress Reparations. We've since changed our name to NIKKEI for Civil Rights and Redress. But Jun Kizu testified on our behalf as an organization, and I'm just going to read her testimony. It's pretty short, but these were the five demands from NCRR. The National Coalition for Redress Reparations firmly believes that this commission should place the priority on correcting the injustices and to submit these concrete solutions to Congress. First, we ask for the continued education of the public about the truth of this event so that the American people of today and in the future may learn from and not repeat past mistakes. Second, we ask the commission to do whatever is necessary and appropriate to overturn the legal basis for the evacuation order so that no branch of government can arbitrarily strip away the freedoms and civil liberties of any group of people. Third, we insist that the government include those of other races and nationalities who suffered similar unjust actions of the government, including the Aleutians, Pribilof Islanders, and Peruvians, in our pursuit for redress. Fourth, we ask for a community fund to help compensate for the sociological damages done by the evacuation, and most importantly, we strongly call for direct monetary compensation to each victim of the concentration camps or to their heirs who were affected by Executive Order 9066.
Over the course of a number of planning meetings, we had some great discussion about the representation of the CWRIC hearings because they were in a range of cities, and I think there were some differences at the various sites. We thought what would probably be best was to talk about L.A., since that's where the majority of us are based or were involved when this took place. But we thought we'd just take a little break here, and I think I'd ask how many people in the audience today actually testified at or were present at one of the CWRIC hearings in the early 1980s. Can I just see some hands? Maybe in the back. Where did you attend? Los Angeles, Chicago. Where else did people? I know Alan Nishio was actually one of our NCR leaders of L.A., but did you go to other venues too? No, okay. Where? Oh, I'm sorry. Chicago, L.A., anywhere else? Well, we wanted to just get some comments. Perhaps would you be able to comment in terms of what you saw, what you participated in terms of Chicago? In other words, we wanted to hear from other people about the other hearings just to, you know, to check it out.
I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I went down to Chicago for one day only and actually missed part most of it. What I heard was some testimonies by some Nisei that were very moving, primarily because they were people, you could tell they were people who had not spoken out. And a lot of stories have been told, but there's one thing to read a story, and it's another to hear and see the people who experienced this. It was very moving to me.
Oh, could you tell? Would you mind telling us your name?
My name is Holly Yasui.
Holly Yasui, right? Yeah, I was at San Francisco, and I have to say, I heard things that I'd never heard before. And again, it wasn't from academicians or people that were used to being on TV or anything like that. But I heard some things that startled me very much. That I never heard people talk about ever before.
What?
San Francisco. Well, I mean, you know, if I remember, and my memory back to 81 is getting a little foggy, but I think I remember a story about rape, somebody being raped in the course of some sort of investigation or visitation by authorities. And A, you know, that's not something that people would really come out and talk about in public about. But, I mean, maybe that exemplifies. And I remember I wasn't at the L.A. hearings, but, you know, just in our conversation, remembered hearing things from the L.A. hearings. There was one terrible story about, I think it was a childbirth that was not properly administered, or there weren't the right. Do you remember the details?
There were at least a couple. Huh?
Dr. Mary Oda's testimony is really compelling because she gave birth in camp towards the beginning of the camp, so the hospitals were understaffed. You know, the nurses were on like 48-hour shifts and completely exhausted. There was difficulty in her childbirth, so they had to use forceps. The child, Madeline, was born with grand mal seizures and severely, you know, like disabilities for all of her life. So Dr. Oda, who is still alive and well, spoke about that and how, you know, that was a physical as well as emotional trauma caused by our government.
Any other recollections of people? Yes, Alan.
Yeah, I think Richard mentioned it somewhat, but what really struck me is how difficult it was to get people to be able to, willing to tell their story at the commission hearings. Because in 1981, most people did not want to talk about camp. And if they did, they talk about the good old days and who they knew, et cetera, and did not want to talk about the pain of the camp. But after the commission hearing, people, it unleashed, I think, within our community, people being willing to tell the bad side, the dark side of the camp experience. And I think that really was a turning point in the whole movement for redress within our community.
Absolutely. Well, let's push on to part two. And thank you very much, everyone, for your commentary. And we'll open it up another couple of times because we want to get your input as we go. But we'd like to move on to some Pacific Northwest testifiers at the commission hearings. So I'll turn it back to Steve for about 7 or 8 minutes of testimony from this area here that we heard down in the L.A. or that were presented down in the L.A. Iteration of the hearings.
I equate the evacuation with rape. A rape victim finds it very difficult to talk about it and suffers from shock. But just as a rape victim must talk about the event to bring about the healing of our community. I was born in the Yakima Valley in the state of Washington. I am from a pioneer farming family. My father came to the United States in the early 1900s with my uncle. They were on their way to Columbia University on a student visa. They joined other young men in Seattle and went off to the Yakima Valley to clear land and to farm. I was a freshman at the University of Washington in Seattle at the outbreak of World War II. It was a typical day in June. Work was over, and dusk had begun to settle over the small town of Wapato, Washington. People began to gather, infants, children, teenagers, adults, and the elderly. And all were Japanese nationals or Japanese Americans, quiet and somber, waiting to board the trains, taking us to a wartime concentration camp. We reached our destination, the Portland Livestock Center, a temporary intern camp. The clanging of the steel gate behind us as we disembarked is a sound I will never forget, for it changed our lives forever. My community of a lifetime had been totally destroyed, never to be same again. My education was interrupted, and it would be almost 40 years before I was able to complete my BA college degree. Too late, for throughout those years, I was denied advancement. This resulted in tremendous economic loss to me. However, the most damaging effect of incarceration was of an emotional and psychological nature. As that gate clanged shut, I realized I was imprisoned without a single criminal charge against me and without the benefit of due process of law. I was there solely because I was Japanese. My birthright as a United States citizen meant absolutely nothing. A sense of frustration, injustice, helplessness, and a nagging sense of shame is something I felt then and I still feel. And I still harbor deep anger that the United States government so blatantly selected only Japanese to incarcerate. And how dare our government ignore this wartime injustice all these years, still remaining reluctant to admit this wartime act was done in haste and lacked good judgment, with the need to right this woeful wrong with monetary restitution for economic, emotional losses and damages and the destructions of our communities we have endured all these years. There is a need to enact legislation making it impossible for mass internment of a racial group or any group without the due process of law, and I still hear the clanging of the gates.
Thank you very much.
Members of the commission, I'm Ray Kiharo Saki from Pasadena. I was born in Wapato, Washington. All my life, my childhood, I was born there. And all my childhood growing up years were spent in Yakima County, Washington, including my years at college and university. At the time of Pearl Harbor, I was a second-year student at the University of Idaho, Moscow. And when Executive Order 9066 was signed, it was not necessary for me to go through the process of removal from the military zone. Moscow was outside of it. My family was taken, but I felt just as if I were also evacuated. I no longer had a home. When the January 1942 order by the Attorney General provided for removal of all enemy aliens, which included Japanese American citizens, from certain designated areas, I was appalled. I, a citizen, was considered both an enemy and an alien. We were all targeted as suspects of disloyalty. My immediate thought at the time was, good gracious, it's like what Hitler has been doing in Germany. My mother suffered a mental breakdown, and she had to be committed to a hospital for the duration of the war. Early release for her was not possible because the doctors didn't believe she could take the camp life. My father had to sell the 80-acre farm lease, equipment, livestock, and household goods to a buyer who had no capital, so he had to take a mortgage on it. After the war, he had to foreclose. What he had built up in 25 years was all gone. In 1948, I filed a claim under the Evacuation Claims Act for my father. The amount of the claim was about $5,000, my best recollection. The government paid $2,500, which did not include labor or potential earnings loss, nor damages for mental sufferings resulting from the evacuation. When the exclusion and detention orders were lifted in 1945, my father and younger brother returned to Yakima County. My mother was released from the hospital at this time to join the family. Since society provides remedy for consequences resulting from wrongs committed by one member of the society on another, it seems very reasonable and appropriate thing for the government to give remedy to Japanese Americans who suffered loss of property, loss of income, loss of potential earnings, and for mental suffering caused by disruption of their lives by evacuation. I recommend a concept of redress or reparation in the form of compensation to individuals who are incarcerated and also others who are not but were directly affected by evacuation. Property losses and mental sufferings are personal matters. I would like to see our government make a positive gesture to right a wrong done. It would add measurably to our country's moral and legal stature. I thank you.
Thank you very much.
So I'd like to invite our panelists again to offer their commentaries, and then we'll open it up for your commentaries.
Well, actually, we were hoping that there were going to be people that knew or were from the Northwest area and were kind of familiar with some of maybe people that had experienced the camps. So we wanted to hear more from you, but I was just thinking to myself, I was listening to both of them, how articulate they were or are and well, were. Rei Osaki was an active member of NCR as well. But, you know, and they're just a couple of examples of the many, many Nisei that were so articulate at the testimonies.
Kathy also reminded me that if anyone had questions about the Los Angeles version of the hearings or about the CWRIC hearings in general, to please feel free to ask.
You know, I'll just take 1 minute to share that although this was a Japanese American community's opportunity to face the commission, we got broad support. It was wonderful because I made a short list of some of the other community folks who came out and testified in Los Angeles. Robert O'Brien from American Friends Service Committee. And if you know the history of you know, the Quakers and the Friends, they were always right there for Japanese Americans. Gilbert Sanchez, Frente de los Pueblos Unidos. He was very, very strong. Tom Bradley, mayor of Los Angeles at that time. Larry Boss from Cal State University Los Angeles Asian Studies Department spoke about economic losses, and it was a huge amount of information that had never been shared before. Fred Okrand, a longtime friend, he was with the ACLU of Southern California. And then for the government, pretty much, the War Relocation Authority's Dylan Myers' testimony was read by Lillian Baker. And Dean Allard represented the U.S. Naval Historical Center in Washington, D.C. So, yes, it really was an opportunity for Japanese Americans. But for those friends who came out and supported us, it was welcome and very much appreciated.
That's great. Well, we have, and it's so important to remember, right, all the different people that stepped forward and were supporters. So I think that's really a great addition to the proceedings this afternoon. So I guess we'll move on then to part three, which would be the impact and effects of the commission hearings. Same format. We'll start with Steve showing us about 7 minutes of video excerpts. We'll have a panel commentary, and then we'll open it up one more time again.
I've been here for 3 days. I've listened to most of the testimony. At the beginning, when I heard about the hearings, I said, the hell with it. I dismissed it with contempt. I changed my mind because I heard what the Niseis were saying. And that affected me very, very personally. It made me think about my own family. And I thought, what would they have felt if they had heard what I had heard on the first day? And I thought of my oldest sister, Shizuko, who I had seen on the weekend before, who had said, I don't believe in redress and I don't believe in reparation. I think if she had been here,
She would have broken down and cried.
That shell
she had created, which is still today, would have been pierced with what her fellow Niseis were saying. And I thought of my mother, and above all, my father. If he had heard that I was speaking here today, he would say, yada yada, go to it. Say, say, do, do, do. But the Niseis and the Iseis and the Sanseis have given their testimony. It's unembellished, it's straightforward, and it's a devastating indictment of our government and of our society. And what I would like to do is pay a personal tribute to all those who came out and gave their testimony, because they are the real teachers of history, because they present the point of view of the victim rather than the warden. I'd also like to pay a tribute to the community organizers who made it possible for the witnesses to appear before the hearings, especially the National Coalition for Redress and Reparation and the many individuals, Nisei, Sansei, and Yonsei, who labored for hours to get witnesses before this hearing. What do I think has been happening in the last 3 days here? To me, it's a collective catharsis. It's a kind of rite of passage. And we're saying we're tired of deferring to white people. We've had it. We've shown too much respect, too much deference for too long. The meaning of the proceedings, the testimony, is that that's over now, from here on out. We will not gunan no more. If adversity is a true test of character, then we Japanese Americans have passed the acid test. We have demonstrated that we are dogged, resilient, and yes, why be modest? A courageous people. Yes, we have been quiet, otonashi, but not anymore. We have become the opposite, yakamashi.
I'd like to turn it quickly to our panelists and then over to the audience.
Okay. I heard reactions to Yuji Ichioka's statements, but he really voiced the feelings of so many of of us, the third generation, that were there. And I just want to speak a little personally for myself. During the commission hearings, which were in August of 1981 in Los Angeles, I had started working at the Little Tokyo Service Center and was lucky enough to actually work in the program that transported the Issei to different things, and one of them was the commission hearings. Unfortunately, my mother had passed away in May, and I just had my first child, in just a few months earlier, So I was a very emotional time for myself. And when we talked about, the families and the need for people to speak out, my feeling was that every family should tell their story. Even if it came from myself, who really wasn't there, I felt that every family that went through something needed to be heard at those commission hearings. So I did testify, the best that I could, getting stories from my uncle. And because unfortunately, I had not asked my mother. So I really knew very, very little, about what she went through, and never asked my grandparents, who only spoke Japanese, and should have asked them. But I just want to talk about the video became so important because the testimonies, as people have said, it just unleashed for the Nisei all of the emotions that they had. It validated the fact that the government was listening to them. For those of us that were there, we had never heard these stories before. Many people just couldn't stay away from the commission hearings and were there morning till night. it brought out Nisei who wanted to join in the movement, people that had or like worked in the department, DWP, Department of Water and Power, truck drivers, people that were looking for a way to express that anger and to put it into a movement. So to me, the commission hearings really was the beginning of a movement. And it was, you know, the organizing skills, the activism of younger people, the energy and the emotions and the history. And as I think as Yuji said, they're the tellers of history from their point of view were very important. The coming together. So we took this video, and Visual Communications again came in because they were part of NCR as well, many of them. And Dwayne Kubo quickly made a edited version of the 23 hours. He did it, like, I think within a few days. And we were ready to take that out and do outreach. So we took that to churches, community centers, schools. You know, that first year was just going out all the time. And I have to tell you, it wasn't on a computer. In 1981, it was carrying TVs. We had to carry TVs, and it was 3/4-inch beta tape. And so these machines, you know, not everybody had it, so we had to carry it with us. Or schools may have had it, universities may have had it. But, you know, the Nisei were still young enough to carry some of the equipment. The cables had to be all connected. And if we're speaking like in Monterey Park to about 75 Nisei senior citizens, you had to have 3 TVs. So that's the kind of setup that was going on. And the Nisei were part of these speaking teams. And so the commission hearings had a life after the commission hearings, because it also allowed other people to speak about their experiences that were in these different churches and communities, and they became part of the movement. So to me, that was the impact of the commission hearings.
As I had mentioned, I was fortunate to work with ISAE pretty closely, and so I could feel the impact that the commission hearings had on ISAE testifiers. But also, as a sansei, I personally felt the power of the commission hearings. Because as I was sitting in the audience, in the auditorium at the San Francisco hearings, I felt almost choked because of the intensity and weight of the testimonies and just the heaviness in the air. And you could really just, you know, it was just so intense. And I remember thinking, I wish that every Japanese American could be there to take all of this in, you know, because it really was a moment. And I think the commission hearings were also pivotal in bringing the generations together. Because I remember Issei and Issei telling Sansei that if it hadn't been for the dedication and hard work of the Sansei, we couldn't have built the redress movement. But I also remember replying that if it hadn't been for the Issei and Nisei testifying at the commission hearings, we wouldn't have been, you know, to tell their stories, we wouldn't have been able to build the redress movement. So it really showed how the generations really had to work together. Each generation played a pivotal role in bringing it all together. And Lane, Kathy Kay, and I are all educators, and so all very keen about how to educate young people and society in general about the incarceration. And as educators, we also know one of the toughest questions is how do we get people to be proactive and vigilant about trying to prevent such events like the incarceration to happen again? And it's really tough because I think the crux of the challenge is that you have to get people to really appreciate and to feel what those consequences are without having actually experienced those consequences. So it's a real dilemma, because people generally learn best from making their own mistakes, right? And so when you think about how do we effectively get people to understand and feel the consequences of the World War II incarceration, that's where the commission process was very important, because the process itself was really instructive, because it showed that there really is hope that you can exert your First Amendment right to petition for redress of grievances and be successful. And so the commission process also allowed people to speak up and call for what they felt was proper redress. And the process allowed NCR to popularize the call for monetary compensation as a necessary component of redress. And finally, having these videos showing the testimonies of Japanese Americans speaking up, telling their stories, allows young people as well as all Americans to learn about these lessons about the incarceration for years and years to come.
So I just wanted to add to this, I participated in the San Francisco hearings and gave a joint statement with my father about the impact of the camps on Nisei school children. And it was only after that that I came up to Los Angeles and began to work with Alan and a range of my friends in NCRR at that point. But I would really have to say, I'm a very traditional academician who was trained to start off by reading things in the library first and looking at theory next and kind of working my research from there. But I really have to share with you that this message about the educational importance of the hearings, the tapes, and grassroots community organizations is a very serious one. And I would say that all of my publications in Japanese American Studies dealing with camps were deeply influenced by working with NCRR, much more so than the literature, theory, or anything else. And I'm so fortunate that I came down to L.A. in 81 and was able to meet people in this organization and related organizations, of course. But it's really been seminal for me, and I would really underscore the fact that it was the organization out of the grassroots that brought so many people forward to talk about the experience. That's the heart, I think, of a sound Japanese-American perspective on what went on in the camps. And I've been trying as best I could to teach this ever since. It's not always easy. And I think that as each year passes, we get further away. And I would, again, really underscore the importance of the L.A. tapes, very systematically documented, but would ask the question, where are the Seattle tapes? Where are the San Francisco tapes? Where are the Chicago tapes? We need to put our hands back on these things because those are only going to become increasingly important. Let me just throw it up. We got one more great piece of tape to share with you that I think you'll find really enlightening and inspiring. But we did want to hear from you. So if you have, again, comments you'd like to share, questions for our esteemed panelists, we've got some hidden people in the audience there like Professor Alan Nishio, who inspired a lot of the good work that went on in L.A. We'd like to talk to you, hear from you. Don't be shy.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Dennis Kuohara. I guess I've been hiding under a rock for too many years of denying this situation. But I'd like to know where NCRR is thinking about going, or how are you proceeding now? In other words, yes, we're documenting the past, and that's important, and preserved for future generations.
Great
question. The injustice that we have had, I agree, is great, but where's the future, and what are you doing for other similar situations from happening?
Yeah. NCRR is particularly rich in this dimension. So, and the name change itself, I think, is an indication, but there's so many things to cover. It's a great question. So
we changed our name to the Nikkei for Civil Rights and Redress somewhere in 1990, 91, 92. And right after 9/11, 2001, was a very important time, and we, and our community really, not just us, it was really our community understood the dangers of 9/11 and what could happen to other communities. We didn't know much about the Arab American community, the American Muslim community, the South Asian community, but immediately, we organized ourselves in Little Tokyo with other organizations to have a candlelight vigil and to publicly put out that, we felt that one is, of course, sympathy with what happened with the people in New York, but also a warning of do not scapegoat other communities, and invited Arab Americans and American Muslims to come to that vigil. And they were very thankful, and they also said that Japanese Americans had been the first to call their mosque or their organization. And from that time, we have built a relationship. We immediately started to learn about their communities, about Islam, and, we had break the fast programs for about the first 4 years, exchanges with organizations like Muslim Public Affairs Council, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and then more recently, in the last 5 years, we had a program with high school youth Japanese American high school youth and American Muslim youth, where we talk about our histories, our community, our cultures, and the issues that we face. You know, one thing is that it is very hard because our community tends to be a little safe and a little bit conservative in that way. So it's always hard to get a lot of Japanese American kids to participate. But we get some and get more American Muslims, but the impact on those kids is pretty strong. And it's an important program that we do with JECL, Kizuna in LA, and CARE LA, and ourselves. So we've been doing that, and they, you know, and really they have taken initiative in going to Manzanar. Busloads of American Muslims from CARE come from LA and also from the Florin area to the Manzanar pilgrimage, jointly with the Japanese American, well, JCL, I think, Florin JCL. So I think that there's a lot of examples of other groups, and I mean the museum has had programs as well, you know, to build that relationship. It's something that you have to constantly work at, though, because they're constantly bombarded. You know, it just repeats itself over and over again.
Just to add on to that, the relationship with the Muslim American community, we've had them speak at our Day of Remembrance programs around February 19th of each year. We've had, you know, different kinds of events, breaking the fast events, which people, some of the folks in the audience have participated in. So it's we have to kind of like continue to sustain that relationship also. But just about 2 weeks ago, representatives from the American Muslim community came out to support the JA community. We were in a struggle with LA City Council to have Tuna Canyon, one of the very first detention sites for our Issei men who were, you know, taken right after like Pearl Harbor and into January. It was a temporary site. It was only open for about 23 months total. But we had to speak and convince the city council that this needed to be a historic cultural monument designation. It was an uphill battle, trust me. It involved developers and lots of other considerations, but representatives from the American Muslim community came out and stood right by us. It was really, really terrific.
We'll touch on this at the end as well, but I guess NCR, we've always had this look to the future, and one of our founding principles of unity was to work towards preventing similar kinds of injustices in the future and supporting other kinds of injustices that we see. And so a lot of us are educators, and so we're always thinking about, you know, how do we get the younger generations or society in general to look at the future and how best to think about how can we guard against, be vigilant, and prepare ourselves to even see, even maybe within ourselves, any kinds of you know, intolerance or, you know, and also try to think of ways of trying to work with other organizations and groups like the American Muslim. So it's kind of like always having this look to the future of knowing that the government's going to be coming up with stuff all the time that we got to guard against. So it's kind of like, okay, so how do we deal with that?
Yeah, good question. And can you please tell us who you are, and then we'll move to a piece of tape. And
yes, I'm Helen Kuwahara. I'm Dennis's wife. Mm-hmm. We've been married for 50 years, mm-hmm. and I have to tell you that it is only recently that we have heard anything about this, and it is only because I have dragged it out of him. His children say, Mom, he won't talk. He needs to talk. And I say, yes, he does need to talk. And I'm so glad that he has started, because he has something to say. He needs to say it, and he needs to say it for everybody and for himself and for his children. I'm so glad we're here today. I've never said this much in one time, I think, in front of people before. Nor with quite this amount of emotion. But it means so much to me that he does talk and does get it out. Because if he don't, it just grows. and eats at you, and I don't want that to happen to him. And our children don't want that to happen to them either. Thank you very much.
I was just going to ask a question of other people here that, you know, we said the power of the commission hearings, and I think that's kind of an example of perhaps, I mean, we're hoping that that would be what the commission hearings did, was open, give people the chance to open up and to share and to talk about what they went through. I'm just curious what impact seeing these videos had on you here. Had you seen them before?
Can you tell us who you are?
Sure. My name is Anora Hirami. I live in Plymouth, Michigan, which is just outside of Detroit. My sister is next to me, who also grew up there, but she's a Seattle resident. And I feel very deeply for you, with gratitude and respect. Our father moved to Detroit with our mother, and we were raised there. And we never saw those hearings. My father started talking about it, but I don't think he ever, to this day, has gone through that kind of catharsis. So I am extremely grateful for the work you did. My dad did not participate in that. I don't think he could have. So I'm extremely grateful for you. And as the children of a mixed marriage, we went through that confusion. I think we inherited his pain. And you do just toughen up, you move on, and you live on, but you inherit your father's pain. So thank you for what you did, even though my dad couldn't.
My name is Sally Sudo. I'm from the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and I chair the Education Committee and a Speakers Bureau for our organization. This is the first time I've ever seen this video on the commission, and I'm wondering how I can get a copy of this, because we go around to many schools, many community organizations. People in our community don't know anything about what happened here on the West Coast, and they think that the Nisei boys who were in the MIS at Fort Snelling were part of a Japanese prison camp. That is where they're coming from. So we really are trying to educate the people in our community, and it would be so powerful to have a video of this type.
So we're educators. We have to prepare. Actually, 13 VHS tapes of approximately 120 minutes each, documenting the whole hearing. You would be able to contact any of our panelists
and visit
our details to purchase maybe some Steve or talk to the dentist. Yeah.
We
any, those of you who could share would just take one and copy and give to others.
All right, we have an NCRR table in the marketplace for those of you who don't get your questions answered. But, Steve, would you speak to the fact that...
Steve, use the mic.
Yeah.
They're recording everything.
We, NCRR and Vision Communications, did transfer the videotapes to DVDs, and we applied for a grant, for the NPS grant, to menu drive it. So that, you know, I mean, do you see a name, you click on the name, you go to the testimonies. I think if you're familiar with DVD structure, that's just automatic. And so we applied for a grant. We didn't get it. We estimated it would be like $6,000 to $10,000 to get the work done to do that. And so we're seeking funds in order to be able to do the 157 testimonies. Right now it's on 13 DVDs. To be able to get that so that people will have access to it. Just recently, this is really odd, that we gave 20 of the testimonies to Dentio, and they got an NPS grant to put it up. Of course, the grants were just announced several months ago, and they will be putting up 18 testimonies of people who were incarcerated, and two other testimonies of people that gave analysis of the camp and their future, you know, experiences with Sansei and other people like that. So, again, like Kay said, we'll be We have a table outside, and we'd love to talk to you more about and get names and that kind of things about how we can keep in contact and continue. We will be having a workshop in L.A. for those of you who are interested in May. I think it's May 3rd in Torrance, in which we will be presenting maybe something similar, maybe with a little bit more of the testimonies.
Hi, I'm Millie McCauley, and I was 5 years old on the island of Kauai at the time of Pearl Harbor. And then a few months after that, my Ojichang, my grandfather, my mother's father, was taken by the FBI, and then all of a sudden we were visiting him in the local jail in Wailua. And, you know, it was very, very confusing to a child like me. We wondered why he had been taken, and it turns out that there were, I believe I found out today, 2,000 people, Japanese and Japanese Americans from Hawaii who were brought up here. Well, a number of years ago at the Japanese American National Museum in L.A., there was a little thing where if you had a relative in the camps, you could put in their name, and then it would say, you know, what information the government had on them. So I put in my grandpa's name, Mankichi Miura, and it didn't come up. So I said to the docent, you know, my grandfather's name isn't here, but I know he was in a camp. Mm-hmm. And the docent said, where was he? And I said, Santa Fe. And he said, Santa Fe was not a relocation camp. Mm-hmm. The relocation camps were run by the Department of the Interior, just like now they run the Bureau of Indian Affairs. But the Santa Fe and about six other camps were really prisons run by the Department of Justice. And it was the first that I knew that, you know, Ojichang was not in a relocation camp. And I remember going to visit him at the jail in Wailua when he was first taken, and he was in an army barracks across from the concrete prison. And he was, you know, hanging out of there and saying hello, and then the next thing we knew, he was gone, you know, he was shipped up to Santa Fe. And then just about that time, his youngest son, my mother's youngest brother, came back from the University of Hawaii. They had tried to volunteer with the Army, but they were rejected. And so they had formed the Varsity Volunteers, and they helped dig ditches and reservoirs, you know, all free, just to show that they were loyal Americans. But when he found his father, who, you know, was a very, very godly man, in jail, he was just outraged. And he said his dad told him, war is not a civilized activity, and this is probably happening to Americans in Japan. So he said, if your country gives you a chance to fight for it, I want you to go. And so eventually my uncle, Dr. David, he joined the 442nd and was injured in Italy and survived, but then was able to attend dental school on the GI Bill. And so, you know, that part was really very good. But we tried to figure out why my Ojichang had been taken, and we think it was because he was a successful businessman. He owned a market and a grocery store in Kapaa, Kauai. But also, he was very devout Buddhist and Shintoist. And before the war, the Shinto priests had gone back to Japan, I guess fearing war. And so they had asked my grandpa to take care of the temple. And so we think that that's probably the key reason why he was taken, because it's, you know, Shinto religion is worship of the sun god, but the sun god is personified in the emperor of Japan. So it was very, very, very interesting. When I heard about this conference, I thought, I have to come, because, you know, I'm not a mainland Japanese, have not suffered, you know, all of the great hurt of the mainland Japanese. But then my grandpa was in prison, and then it turns out that another aunt who I think was married to a man who was born in Japan on Kauai, they also were sent up here, as well as an aunt by marriage. But I'm so glad that you're having this. It's just wonderful.
Thank you for sharing that story with us. We've got... he would like to, and Barbara, and then we'll get to the... We don't have a session after, so we can run over a little bit. I understand.
I participated in the Eastern Illinois hearing, which was in the city of Chicago. And the one thing that I noted, we were a little more selective in our people that were presenting, because like in our chapter, we were three of our 300 people in our Wisconsin chapter that we had sent to the hearings. And so, one happened to be a minister, one happened to be an engineer that was a owner of a company, and I guess I was the lone educator of the bunch. But at any rate, we attended the Illinois one. We didn't have such theatrics as we had at these others. However, I think it's important to say one of the things that happened is that the individual that was a lone dissenter of the dozen or so people that were at the hearing was Lundgren. And Lundgren got booted from our district in our last election. And I want you to know and keep in mind, these people are elected individuals, and they hear the vote of the people. And that is the most important thing that we can do. And naturalization is a very important thing. And I emphasize that with all the individuals, although I'm not a social studies educator, but I think it's important that we consider the fact that voting is essential. And let's say solid groups of voting. And I think this is one of the things that I emphasize to all people, that we need to be a good, intelligent voting bloc. And I think that we need to think about that.
Can you remind us of your name, please?
Ellen Hita.
Ellen Hita. Okay, let's take a comment from Barbara, and then we'll go to Steve in our last tape segment.
I've had the opportunity, I'm Barbara Bellis, I've had the opportunity to see a lot of tapes and sit at JANM and other places and the rich, rich resources. I saw something today I had never seen before, and it just literally dropped my jaw when Lillian Baker jumped up and violently seized a piece of paper. It's like, it will not be if I grab this paper away from... What was she thinking? This is bizarre. It's like Holocaust deniers. There were not people who got burned. You did not experience that. And the fact that there were, I don't know what they were, rangers, the uniformed people who protected him, that was one of the strangest things I think I have ever, ever seen on tape. That's bizarre. And it reminds me of one other bizarre thing that no one has brought up, and it shouldn't take our attention away from what the testimony was. But there were those who, unlike Yuji Ichioka, did not change their minds about the value of the commission strategy. There were those who said, not only should we not do it, it's like proving you were raped, we're not going to do it, but now the people coming forward are, and this is a quote, a circus of freaks.
there were so many things that were happening around this time in which people were able to support one another. And I just want to name four things that I'm aware of from the time I began to be involved in the redress movement. One of them are the Days of Remembrance in the late 1970s, and the first one was here, and the second one was in Portland. And in my writing about Min Yasui, the sansei who heard Min Yasui speaking at the 1978 Day of Remembrance said, "I've never heard a nisei talk like that." The power of the Days of Remembrance, it seems to me, is part of what helped the same kind of energy happen at the CWRIC hearings. And two other things. One was the beginnings, and I know it was long before I knew about this, but I knew the pilgrimages, and I think Manzanar was perhaps the first. I was aware of Minidoka because I was pastor of the Japanese American Church in Portland, Oregon, and I had lived in Twin Falls, Idaho. People going to Minidoka and telling the stories, it's very much like this intergenerational kind of energy. So I think the Days of Remembrance, the pilgrimages, the commission hearings, and the Coram Nobis cases all came together. Coram Nobis means before us again. And I have this image in my mind always about the Coram Nobis cases, Day of Remembrance, the commission. We had one outcome legally in the 40s from Min Yasui, Gordon Hirabayashi, and Fred Korematsu. But in the 1980s, those cases came before the court, before the community, before the nation again. It'll always be a great grief to me that when redress passed 25 years ago, Min was 2 years gone. So Yasui did not live to see the passage of redress, that he literally went down to the wire in his hospital bed making calls to people and saying, "Get, write a letter now." People were getting out of their sick beds. It was just stunning. And yet he had a sense that the legacy was worth it, even if he didn't personally live to see it. And that kind of energy, even the Lillian Bakers and the other bizarre attackers, can never be stronger than that kind of clarity and commitment and telling the truth.
Thank you. We'd like to show you one more video clip, and then we'll wrap up.
Up until that time, as you all know, people didn't talk about it as openly. Only those who were angry and were more progressive in thought and wanted to get the story out. And there were few and far between. Having been so unjustly treated one time like that, despite the fact we were citizens of the United States, they weren't sure if they spoke out that something bad would happen again. So it was good, but once it started, then a momentum began. And people say, "Hey, so-and-so, my neighbor spoke, I think I can talk too, And with each city, I think people got more and more courageous. So it was it's a good thing that the hearings did happen. I wish that I were able to be at every one of those hearings. Oh, I think it motivated the community because the hearings made it okay to talk about it now. That was the big thing. And then I think on the whole, most of the population, Nikkei population, it was like a dark cloud lifting off your shoulder. But there still remains, and even to this day, a little bit of discrimination, I think, against those who were involved in the Tule Lake segregation. Because I think we've sort of gotten over the hurdle of the draft resistors. I'm not sure in the veterans community whether or not that still sits comfortably with them. But I think that there seems to be some pretty good progress being made in terms of the Tule Lake situation. I think the commissioners, when they drew up the basis for the report, counted a great deal on the hearings to base the case. The hearings were critical in terms of the report being written the way it was and its effect on having the Congress pass the Civil Liberties Act. Well, I think that it remedied some part of the injustice that occurred to one minority group. But the larger lesson is what I mentioned to you before, the future. Why is there a provision in a brand new law that allows for indefinite detention without due process? Now, that was one of the main things that was the desired effect of the Civil Liberties Act, that it should not, this kind of thing should not happen again. But there it is. Again, there should be strong, active movement to get that Defense Authorization Act, part of it, whatever part of it is not really justifiable, that they should, that should be rescinded. That's one of the main things I would hope can come out of the activism of the young folks today, and as a result of the Civil Liberties Act, which I thought, this is good. You know, this is going to help the country become stronger.
I'd like to pay due respect to Aiko because she, as the notes said, was a researcher for the CWRIC, and she and her husband would go to the National Archives and labored, slaved, to find information that helped with the ultimate report from the commission hearings across the country, Personal Justice Denied. And so her contribution was tremendous. And even the hearing, this interview Kathy and Steve did was last week. I mean, it was like she's still very, very strong and adamant that, you know, what needs to be done. I'd like to say that she mentioned briefly the importance of the commission's findings. If you're not too familiar with it, they found in their report in 1983 that the incarceration was based primarily on race prejudice, wartime hysteria, and the failure of political leadership. Those are really, really key items, and it kind of just nails it. But then they went further to say they recommended the $20,000 individual monetary compensation, and I believe they recommended for an education fund. So that was key also. So when the CLA came, you know, here we move forward to 1987 and 88, amongst all the different movements, besides, you know, NCR's grassroots movements, JACL worked with the legislative, you know, members and different groups, you know, everybody worked hard on this. I think the backdrop to all of it was that the government's own commission recommended this. How could they ignore it? Well, of course they could have, because we didn't know if Ronald Reagan was going to sign this bill. Ultimately, he did. I do want to say that the hearings, you know, besides the legislative part, were really, really, you know, very, very important. It offered the education fund. And so NCRR and over 300 different grants have been given from the original CLPEF, the Civil Liberties Public Education Fund, that came with the Civil Liberties Act. It was supposed to be $50 million, but ended up $5 million. And there was a board, and funds, grants were given. And then because of good people in California, too, we got the California Civil Liberties Public Education Fund. And it is renewable every year, and it has already contributed over $8.8 million in projects to teach, to tell about, you know, the story. Aiko mentions also very, very important, what now? And, of course, that is the importance. This is the 25th anniversary of the CLA. This conference is marking that and saying speak out. And whether the speaking out takes a form of making sure you cast an informed vote, and or speaking out against injustice to other groups, we have in front of us the NDAA. This we have a small flyer with some brief information about it. It certainly is available on internet. It still, as has been said, authorizes the detention, unlimited, indefinite detention of citizens. You know, we don't want to go there. And I think unless we really do speak to our elected officials and others about it, it's there. I'm going to wrap up by saying, for me, you could see that the testifiers, it was life-changing for the testifiers. Huge, huge impact, catharsis. I was in the audience. I did not testify. It was also life-changing for me, and I don't use that lightly. I grew up in that culture of silence, very typically or stereotypically J.A. Asian. Like others have stated, my parents didn't want to talk about it. We didn't talk about it. Also, they were of the school of thought. To be a good girl was to be seen and not heard. I did not speak, okay? It took really becoming a teacher to make me more comfortable to address my students. But NCRR and meeting this group of people at the commission hearings, I attended, and that day I joined NCRR and, you know, haven't looked back since. It's been about 32 years, you know. So I want to say that I think that the commission hearings, you know, have been a major, major part of my life because it brought me and involved me with NCRR, which, of course, is another huge part of my life. Our legacy, repeating, our legacy. Please do continue to think very, very seriously about, you know, what we've discussed. Get more information. Certainly come, you know, to the table and Lane's bibliography. And continue this.
I hope that you've enjoyed this afternoon's panel and really want to thank Richard, Kay, Kathy, Steve and Peggy Nagano, Alan, who I guess left. But here's the concluding word, that this was a watershed moment, these hearings, when Japanese American community members spoke out, right? And they spoke out both in terms of damages, but very much in terms personal and collective damages, but also very much in terms of identifying the government as the responsible party for these actions and demanding redress, which would be basically an apology, and reparations, which involves at least a token monetary compensation for the violation of constitutional rights. What I'd like to underscore again is that my working with NCR has really been a privilege, and it's really informed really the bulk of my work in Japanese American studies across the board. So if you found this inspiring, please talk to our panelists. Please talk to Steve and Peggy. Alan's still around. They would be happy to come to your church, to your organization, to your chapter of the JACL. You can really invite them out to hear about the concrete work they did to make this kind of thing happen. But also they have a vision for the future in terms of what Kay was outlining. So I would really encourage you to hang out, meet them, and if you like what they have to say and you want to hear more, invite them out because they've got a lot of things to teach us.
Invite Lane, too.
Thank you very much.